Hey, hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And before we get into this eye-opening episode with Sam Callahan about the Bank of International Settlements, I want to share a quick word about our amazing sponsor, CipherSafe. They provide important tangible security tools for Bitcoiners. CipherSafe seed storage devices focus on securing your Bitcoin with beautiful, elegant, practical devices that are machined from solid stainless steel. To really own your Bitcoin and have sovereignty over your money, you need to take self-custody of your BTC and get it off of your exchange. Go that extra step and secure your Bitcoin from a single point of failure and physical disaster with a Cypher Wheel or the new Cypher Grid seed storage device. The Cypher Wheel is designed to be physically locked with a padlock and comes with a tamper-evident seal, so you can be aware of any attempts to steal your seed words. It's also waterproof, fireproof, rustproof, and foolproof, so keep your sats safe. Go to CypherSafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. If you are new to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast or a longtime listener, please make sure to subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform and on YouTube. I just re-entered the fiat mine, so I'm a bit behind on the YouTube channel, but I'm going to catch up over there. Also, if you could write a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform and tell your friends and family about the show or your favorite episode, that really helps us grow and get the show out there. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix for this important conversation with Sam Callahan from Swan Bitcoin about the BIS and their mission to support central banks' pursuit of monetary and financial stability through international cooperation.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Sam Callahan is a Bitcoin analyst at swanbitcoin.com. He's been dropping some fire threads from behind enemy lines, studying, analyzing, and explaining global organizations like the IMF, the World Bank, and the Bank of International Settlements, or the BIS. And I thought it'd be great to get to know Sam a bit more. Sam Callahan, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix. How are you?
Good, Cedric. Happy to be here.
Yeah. We actually got to meet in person. It's got to be almost a year ago now. We met in the lobby, I think, in the hotel at BitBlock Boom in Dallas.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a great time.
Yeah, I think Brendan Lane, your coworker, grabbed me. And yeah, you guys were hanging out, and I got to know you a bit. I think you had just joined Swan maybe a couple months before that.
Yeah, man, that must have been a couple months. That nailed it.
Yeah. So what is a Bitcoin analysts do at a company like Swan? Maybe tell us a little bit about Swan and what you do there then.
Sure. Swan's a Bitcoin brokerage company. So we sell Bitcoin, but we're also kind of like focused on education, and we're kind of can be better thought of as like a Bitcoin financial services company, because now we're trying to branch out into financial advisors, building a platform for them, high net worth individuals. I'm trying to give them the tools they need, because everyone has different needs, given if how much money you have or if there's rules and regulations for financial advisors. So Swan's trying to just provide infrastructure for them to get access to this new asset class. And as a Bitcoin analyst at Swan, I'm really focused on research. So I do a lot of research, do a lot of writing. A lot of the newsletters that come out of Swan, usually, you know, I'm writing those and doing the monthly insight report, which is more of an in-depth research report on a specific topic. So last month I did one on kind of Coinbase and some of their listing practices and how these coins do. I've done deep dives into the correspondent banking system that runs the cross-border payments and Lightning. So really I just like pick a subject and go really deep into it. And then I also do a bi-weekly market update for our private clients, which is kind of like a macro update and a Bitcoin market update. So that could cover everything from, you know, making charts and just telling them what's going on, some cool fundamental developments that have occurred, or keeping them up to date about like regulatory updates and everything in between. So that's kind of what I do as a Bitcoin analyst now, and I really enjoy it.
Awesome. Swan is a great company. I love Swan. I've had most of the fellows from Swan on the show covering various topics. And, you know, I'm kind of curious, though, how much has Swan changed over the last year, and how much has your role changed maybe over the last year since I saw you in Dallas?
It's changed a lot. I mean, we've grown a lot. We're a young company, and so we're always trying to kind of handle the demand essentially for Bitcoin. And 2021 was a big bull market for Bitcoin. And so we've grown a lot. You know, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but we're definitely over 50 employees, but probably north of 60 now. Year ago, I was the 25th employee. So think about how much growth that is just from people wise. But then also as a product, we've really matured, and we offer a really full suite of products now. From Swan Private, which is our high net worth individuals. Because like I said, they need different things. We do Swan Gifting now. We do Bitcoin benefit plans. We've really just shipped a lot of product compared to 1 year ago, when it was really about retail and dollar cost averaging, which is still our flagship product, but we really kind of expanded. And that's a testament to our awesome engineers and you know, product team. That's kind of the secret sauce of Swan. I don't think they get enough credit. They just always deliver. So the company's changed a lot. We've matured a lot. We've grown a lot. And personally, you know, when we met, I was kind of wearing a lot of hats, as you usually do in a young startup. I was working in client customer service. I was doing a little bit of writing. I was working in compliance. I was kind of wherever I was needed. I was a utility player. And now I'm very, very focused on just research and as an analyst. So definitely a different role for me. Swan looks like a different company, but it's all good things. And it's been a roller coaster.
Yeah. And what did you think of BitBlock Boom? Was that your first Bitcoin conference?
No, because I went to Miami earlier before that.
Okay.
But I love BitBlock Boom. It's probably my favorite. I think there's a lot of signal there. I like the smaller ones where you can kind of meet people and have good conversations. And the BitBlock Boom one last year was just special, man. Like that hotel lobby, everyone was just hanging out. The bar was there. I think each night we were out pretty late, but the conversations were just so good. You know, I had to stay up for them. So I can't wait for BitBlock Boom next year. I think it's in August or this year, right? So
yeah,
I'm going there, and it's going to be awesome. Fun.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm on the same schedule as you. This will be my fourth Bitcoin conference, but my second time at BitBlock Boom and twice in Miami. BitBlock Boom is definitely my favorite as well, just in terms of it's just a lot more honed, focused, and intimate. And I like how you get to see a lot of the same people continuously over a few days and really kind of build a rapport. And and Gary just runs a fantastic conference.
He does a great job. I mean, it's just very really smooth does. And it's good times, good events. Everyone just has a blast. So highly recommend it if somebody's thinking about buying a ticket.
Yep. And so I'd love to turn to the Bank of International Settlements. These guys seem like the biggest boys at the table. But there's not a lot. They're not thrown around every day in everyday conversation. So it's kind of an enigma to a lot of people, including myself. So what is the Bank of International Settlements, and how do we even frame it up? Like, what do they do, and when did they start doing it?
Yeah. So they're actually one of the oldest, what I would call international financial institution. So they've been doing it for a long time, since 1930. So who are the Bank of International Settlements? I think the best way to think about them is a bank for central banks. So just think about any kind of commercial bank, like a Wells Fargo or a Chase, and think about the services they just provide an individual. And the Bank of International Settlements basically does that for central banks. And so it makes its money from fees and commissions that it charges central banks for its services. It does things like gold swaps, it does short-term loans, like liquidity for the central banks, and provides like a full suite of investments and opportunities that they can invest in. It's also a bank itself. So they try to get their own risk-adjusted returns based off their profits. But so they're just kind of at the top of this heap. Now, at the same time, they've also kind of morphed into what I would call like an elite event planner. So they hold seminars and they have various committees and conferences for these central bankers in their headquarters in Switzerland. And so their headquarters can be thought of like a clubhouse for central bankers to discuss important topics with confidence that no one's going to ask hard questions. There's no reporters there. There's no pesky politicians there. The central bankers can let their guard down and start being honest with each other about the challenges that the global financial system faces. And so they're also this event planner. And probably their most integral role today is their research firm for these central banks. So they have the world's largest restricted database of banking information. So they have all this mainframe computers that sweep up the data about the flows of transnational finance. And so they collect statistics on international banking activity and computerize its data repository. You know, it pays them handsome dividends right now for that data. If you just think about how valuable data is nowadays. Well, the Bank of International Settlements has the most financial data in the world. So they sell it to these central banks. And so the bank has like rapidly become the most informed financial institution in the world concerning cross-border payments and the flow of international capital. So I like to think about them as like Lord Sauron, like the Lord of the Rings guy, eye in the sky. They have the best vantage point. They can see everything. And so that gives them a lot of power to tell these other central banks about what's going on in the world. So to wrap it up, you know, they're just a bank for central banks. They're an elite event planner where they hold these seminars and really elite conferences for these central bankers. And then they are the eye in the sky research database that kind of provides research for these central banks, and they sell it to them. Wow. So that's what the Bank of International Settlements is today.
Right. Now that's what they do today. But I mean, and that's a lot to unpack, and I'd love to get into all of that shortly. But when did they form, and how did their power get seeded, or who kind of sponsored their charter?
Yeah, so this goes back to really World War One. Okay, so when World War One ended, it was the Versailles Treaty, and the Versailles Treaty was really unfair. It basically put all the blame on Germany. And Germany basically got all these war reparations to pay for the war, and their whole, their entire country was destroyed. Their men had died by the millions. They didn't have the productive capacity to even come close to paying off these war reparations. And so what happened was the Weimar hyperinflation of the early 1920s. And coming out of that, they basically couldn't pay off their war reparations anymore. And it became really a messy situation where, France wanted its money, Great Britain wanted its money, and America, they kind of stepped in and be like, we got to help Germany because Germany's kind of integral to the global economy itself. And so basically they thought it was a good idea. They got together at something called the Hague Convention. And out of that Hague Convention created a national neutral bank to basically facilitate these war reparations. And so they wanted a neutral party. And in that process, I don't know if they knew this or not, but they created a bank outside any kind of regulation. It was set by international treaty. And so there was basically complete legal immunity completely. And it still exists to this day the same way, which is why, nobody can really enforce anything on the Bank of International Settlements. There's nobody above them, because way back in 1930 at this Hague Convention, they incorporated this international bank under international treaty to really help with these war reparations. So that's kind of how they started. And I'll kind of leave it at that for now. But
where are they incorporated?
Basel, Switzerland. So,
and what is their relationship with Switzerland then?
So the thing about it is, there's nothing that Switzerland can do with the Bank of International Settlements. And that's kind of the crazy part, because they basically can't go into the business premises. They can't seize any of their assets. When people who work for the Bank of International Settlements come there, they're treated like basically like a UN diplomat. So they have complete legal immunity. And so really there's not really, they don't pay taxes. They don't pay income taxes. They just, they're kind of in Switzerland, but Switzerland itself can't do anything when it comes to the biz. And it's because they're protected under international treaty, like I mentioned before. So that kind of protects them from everything.
Right. It seems like they, a couple of things here. I'm kind of curious whether you think this was a power grab or a power vacuum, and they didn't realize how much power they were giving to this neutral organization. And whether they stumbled upon reparations as sort of extortion.
Well, that's a good question, because I think it's a little bit of both. I think there was a couple guys who were really pushing for this neutral bank, and it's the same people that really were considered the Lords of Finance. There's a book called The Lords of Finance that looks at the history of central banking, right? And I've one of their names is Montague Norman, who is the Bank of England guy. The other guy, I always butcher his name. He's German, starts with an S. But those two were really pushing the plan of the Bank of International Settlements. And I think they knew exactly what they were doing. I think they wanted a neutral bank because they were sick of listening to all these restrictions from governments. And their big idea was, hey, we are members of high finance. We don't care about these short-term problems politically. All we care about is financial stability and maintaining global finance. So they thought they were like above everyone else, and they wanted a bank to be above everyone else as well. And so they're really the architects of the Bank of International Settlements, the same guys who really formed the central bank system that we know today. And that's a great book, The Lords of Finance, for somebody who hasn't read it. So I think they knew what they were doing. Now, the Hague Convention wasn't just those two guys. They basically had to convince everyone else. And it was a tough sell because there was like some pushback between like, what is this bank? But they got what they wanted. And now, you know, it still remains till this day legally untouchable, the Bank of International Settlements. So I think the war reparations kind of helped provide profits for this bank. And they liked it. It's how they survived for a long time. It was basically a guaranteed revenue stream, basically to collect these war reparations and facilitate them to the other central banks of the winners of World War One. So I think that was a big part of it. But eventually, those war reparations stopped when Hitler just said, "No, we're not going to pay these anymore. They're basically a stain on the pride of Germany." And so they just basically reneged on all their war reparations. So at that point, the biz had to kind of pivot. But that's kind of I'll leave it there. But
yeah, where'd they pivot to? How'd they survive World War II if their business model was kind of shattered with, you know, Germany saying no more?
Well, the way that they pivoted was it was actually innovation. So, you know, so if you think about like why the biz was started, it was the war reparations, but after only 5 years old, they had already lost its primary reason for existence when Germany canceled those war reparations. So the question started to come up, like, what's the bank's role and function? Well, they created something called earmarked gold. At that time, it was difficult for nations to, you know, pay with gold. It was still like fundamental to the financial system, and they had to ship it across seas, and there was all kinds of risks. And so what the biz did was basically at each central bank, there would be a biz sub account in each bank, and they would have earmarked gold traded between biz accounts. And so it was a way for them to transfer property very easily and quickly with just a bookkeeping change in the biz's sub accounts. And so earmarked gold was a huge growth vector for the biz from like 1935 to 1936. It was like a new mechanism for gold and foreign currency exchange. And the biz was kind of the facilitator of all those earmarked gold kind of transfers and transactions. And they took a little fee from there. So that's kind of how they just kind of pivoted from a person who facilitated or a bank that facilitated war reparations to a bank that facilitated cross-border payments and specifically gold transfers between countries. And so that's kind of how it led up to World War II.
But during World War II, I mean, there's probably a ton of gold transfers. Were all these gold transfers above board, or were any of these nefarious?
So this is where, you know, the biz has a really questionable history during World War II. If you think about World War II, a lot of the cross-border payments between countries slowed down. And so now the biz, you know, what I just said, where that was kind of their primary way of getting revenue from 1935 to, let's say, 1939, before the outbreak of war. Now the countries weren't really transferring as much together. You know, people were divided. There was the Allies and the Axis, and kind of there was a breakdown of global trade during the war. And so what the biz did to stay alive was basically they supported the Nazis. So they kind of feigned a neutral stance publicly, but in reality, they really helped the Nazis basically take the gold that they confiscate from conquered nations and kind of allow them to hold it in their Bank of International accounts. Because what I just said before was each central bank in the world had a biz account. And so when the Nazis would invade, say, Czechoslovakia, they couldn't necessarily get access to that biz account. And so what they did was they basically put a gun to the head of the Czechoslovakian central bankers. And they said, call the biz or write the biz. I don't know, you know, and they said, we want you to move the bank from the Czechoslovakia biz sub account into our Germany sub account. So I want you to move the gold because we own Czechoslovakia now. And the biz did that with the gun to their head. That's like the people of Czechoslovakia's gold. That's their nation's wealth that's built up over time. They transferred it against Czechoslovakians, you know, well-being into Germany's biz sub account. Okay, so that's super controversial because, like I said, that's the people's money of Czechoslovakia that they just moved after the Nazis conquered it. And then if you a lot of Germany was paying the biz with looted gold from Jews and the Nazi occupied countries. And so it's they have a really dark history during World War II that didn't get exposed till the late 90s. And then once it was exposed in the late 90s, they kind of came clean about that. And so it's pretty, pretty damning considering that they still hold about $3 billion worth of gold. And, it's not crazy to say that that gold is probably from Holocaust victims in the business accounts today. So,
wow,
pretty wild.
It's kind of analogous to the $5 wrench attack, but on, you know, country to country there. But the person on the other end of the line is supposed to recognize that you're under duress and not make the transfer when you're in some sort of custodial system. Do you think the biz there was purely profit driven or immorally driven in some way to aid the Nazis?
I think they were profit driven, actually, because I think they were in trouble. I think, like I said, their streams of revenue had driven up, and the Nazis were one of their best customers during World War II. They kind of kept their doors open, to be honest with you. So I think it was profit driven. It's really interesting because the president of the Bank of International Settlements at the time was American. And so if you think about, you are helping the enemy of World War II by continuing to facilitate banking services for them. People don't realize how important that is during war. Mm-hmm. Like, how was Germany supposed to get war material, vital war materials, and create and carry out foreign exchange and transactions for food? So the biz basically opened the window to the outside world for Nazi Germany. And if the biz didn't have them, or the Germany didn't have the biz, it would have been ended a lot earlier, because they simply wouldn't have been able to continue on with the war machine. And so as an American president, it's really interesting when you dig into that history, because the Americans saw right through this. So the biz would say they're a neutral bank. Oh, we don't pick sides, blah, blah, blah. And meanwhile, this American president's really helping Nazis who are killing Americans, you know, in France at the exact same time. And so the history of the biz in World War II is fascinating and dark, is how I would say it.
Yeah, it's astonishing the connections between certain factions of leadership in the U.S. and the Nazi Party during World War II. And, you know, you think about today with how we, you know, countries use economic sanctions in a way the biz was not using it then at a pivotal point economically in the war. This makes me think, what is the governance structure or within the biz, and what I'm getting at there is, do certain countries have more sort of voting rights or influence at the biz?
Yeah, so not necessarily. The biz is, biz has like a managing director who, that guy's named Augustin Karstens, and everyone kind of knows that guy's, and that's voted on by a board, and the board consists of just members of high finance and central bankers. So this is you know, I think Christine Lagarde's on the board right now, and you know, Ben Bernanke has been on it in the past. So it's just like the who's who of high finance, of central bankers. And it's really important to understand the Bank of International Settlements is they see themselves as above countries. Like, they think what they're doing is more important than any kind of, you know, small political issues. That's how they see it. They have a noble mission of creating financial stability and improving cross-border payments and doing all these things to provide stability. And so they really see themselves as above any kind of nation or nationality. And that's how they like promote themselves publicly as well. And that's kind of what I was mentioning with World War II, where they said like, hey, we're just a neutral bank. That's how they like people to view them. And that's why they never come up either, because they're always in the background, just kind of doing, you know, the flows of finance and doing the research, but really they're actually much more central and important and vital than a lot of people realize. But I just don't think they like people to see themselves that way. And so the structure is they basically have a board, I believe it's like 18 of them, and they kind of swap out every now and then. And then they have a managing director who kind of runs the day-to-day, and that's Augustin Karstens.
Got it. What kind of profits are we talking about here? Can we get a handle on this? And when I say profits too, I mean, salaries and profits. I mean, do we know what these board directors are making, both in salary and or even back end equity? And are we talking about revenue streams that are just beyond the pale?
I don't know about their salaries. I don't think they're low, but I don't know specifics about that. I do know, I've looked into their actual profits of the Bank of International Settlements, because since 2019, you know, their profits are way, way up, because when the Fed basically laid out those liquidity lines coming out of COVID, and they needed to move dollars more and more, it was the Bank of International Settlements who facilitated all those payments. So COVID's actually been really good to the Bank of International Settlements. You know, I forgot the exact numbers, but it's in the, you know, billions every single year of net profit for the Bank of International Settlements. I think the 2020-2021 net profit was 1.3 billion SDR. So that's their unit of account. That's the special drawing rights, which is issued by the IMF. But I think it's equal to like $1.1. So you can do that math. But yeah, they pull in billions of dollars. And they go to, and then the once they get the profits, there's basically 63 member banks that make up the Bank of International Settlements. And you can become a member if you become a big enough nation who's important, has a big enough GDP, big enough political influence. You become a member bank of the Bank of International Settlements. And those profits are kind of divvied up to those central banks of those, the member banks, okay? So each nation becomes a member bank, and then the profits are given to the central banks of those nations.
And yeah, then we're talking about $1 billion a year or 1.1?
Like, yeah, 1.2 billion was in 2020 to 2021. That was that year's profit. So part of it goes out to it as a dividend to these central banks of these member banks. And then there's three funds that they go into. So one's called the General Reserve Fund, one's called the Special Dividend Reserve Fund, and one's called the Free Reserve Fund. And this is where it becomes a black box, where it's like, who knows what they use those funds for. I think one of them is for like emergency needs in case a member bank has a financial crisis, they'll be able to give them a short-term loan. I know that's where one of the funds are used, but I couldn't find information about what happens in the General Reserve Fund or the Free Reserve Fund, where these profits go. And it's really bizarre thinking about this international bank with legal immunity getting profits, right? It's just kind of a weird thing. And like, what are they doing with it? And they have no oversight whatsoever. So it's a good question. It's something that I've looked into, but it kind of hit a dead wall after I found those funds, but maybe I'll dig deeper one of these days.
Yeah. Well, what about the balance sheet? Do we know anything about the balance sheet? How large or how small it is, or?
So they post it. Every year they do like this yearly report. And so you can see, like I said, that you can see how much gold deposits they have. You can see how much currency deposits they have. You can see their net profits. But that's about it. You basically just know how much they have. I think they have either $2 billion or $3 billion worth of gold deposits that I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, it's been a while. I haven't looked at those numbers in a while, but it's they're doing well.
Numbers were going to be a lot bigger, to be honest.
Yeah,
I'm still trying to figure out. Yeah, I was expecting maybe even bigger numbers. But what is an SDR? Maybe tell us a little bit more about the SDR and how they're using it. Because I think a lot of us think about it more as a hypothetical. And I don't think we're as aware that they're using it as their unit of account.
The SDR is a special drawing right. So essentially, it was created by the IMF in the 1970s to basically fix the Triffin dilemma. It basically provided liquidity for, like, so the U.S. didn't have to run these massive deficits. It could start to calm these down. If the U.S. did that in the early, before Nixon took us off the gold standard, it would have really pulled liquidity out of the economy and been really tough for the rest of the world when the U.S. reduced the deficits. That's basically the Triffin dilemma. And so they thought that another currency, a global currency, could help kind of patch things up if the U.S. ever had to, you know, reduce liquidity in the system by reducing its own deficits. And so the special drawing right came about. At first, it was like pegged to gold because that was the system at the time. Now it's just a basket of currencies, basically a basket of fiat, where most of it is the U.S. dollar. I think the U.S. dollar makes up like 50% of it. And then it's the euro, and then it's the yen. It's kind of all your big fiat currencies. The SDR just equals a basket of those currencies. And I believe they equal like $1.2 right now. And the IMF issues it, but then the Bank of International Settlements uses it as their unit of account. So everything is priced in SDRs at this international level of finance. So IMF uses it, Bank of International Settlements uses it. And so they kind of, and the World Bank. So those are like the SDR folks
that they still maintain use it as their unit of account. To the basket of currencies.
Mm-hmm. Right. Basically, so, it's basically just they kind of reset the makeup of the basket, I think every 5 years. So they kind of just shift it around. And then the exchange rate kind of fluctuates a little bit in like a band. But
right. Do they have, this might be a naive question, but do they have any ability to print or issue SDRs?
The Bank of
or change the peg in a way that they could kind of print money? Do they have any ability to do that, or do they just maintain a sort of true peg? And because I'm kind of curious also how they get a unit to be worth more than the dollar when, under my understanding, most currencies are pegged to the dollar. So it seems rather self-referential. Yeah.
It's kind of like just a fiat on top of a
It doesn't make a lot of logical sense to me, but there seems to be buy-in here.
It's weird, right? So, I mean, there's no, the SDR, it was created and now it's like this basket of currency. And it is, so they do kind of print money, because if you think about how money is created, even in like the Federal Reserve System, it's usually created when banks create deposits, banks create loans. Mm-hmm. That's when money's actually created. And so when the IMF creates a loan out of thin air for a country, they're basically creating SDRs.
They just mark the balance sheet with the SDRs that they issue, right?
Yeah.
So like, how do they maintain the peg then?
That's a good question.
A threshold they got
to
be.
There has to be some kind of balance, but you know, I haven't gotten into that.
I would think the rebalancing is in their favor of being able to debase their own SDRs.
Well, here's the thing, is that Cedric, there's no oversight.
Right.
With these institutions. So it's impossible to know. And there's nobody's looking over their shoulder saying, like, are you doing that correctly? So it's kind of hard. It's hard to tell, because that's what these international organizations, they just have no, they have all this legal immunities and they have no oversight, no regulatory oversight. I mean, I think the IMF has this internal oversight unit. Mm-hmm. And so that's the extent of it. So it's a good question. I haven't gone into that granularity into it yet, but
oversight is a really good word, because we don't have a lot of oversight into them, but it seems like they have a lot of oversight into what's going on outside of their purview, or in terms of just being able to see into all the other banks and all the other transactions. So how has their sort of data repository grown, and the things that they're doing with this data? What are they doing with all this data? What have you learned about studying some of their papers there?
Yeah, so the data really comes from actually the IMF. So, I mean, the IMF in 1967 or 1965 to 1967, they did a 2-year study on the global financial system. They wanted to know like what was going on exactly. Out of that study, one of the recommendations was that all central banks in the world should aggregate their data and give it to the Bank of International Settlements, so that we could have a single, you know, entity who could understand everything what's going on and put out research. So that was like a recommendation. And so that's why the Bank of International Settlements has so much data now. It's because, you know, the central banks of each jurisdiction basically collects data on all the banking in their jurisdiction, and then they aggregate it, and then they give it to the Bank of International Settlements, who then has it all, right? And so actually the problem with data right now, you know, in 2020, it was reported that 80% of central banks are using big data with machine learning, you know, and that's up 30% like 5 years ago. Okay. And over 70% of them using it for economic research, and 40% state that they use it to inform about policy decisions. So they use big data. Now, the problem right now is that they're finding is they have too much of it. They don't have the kind of infrastructure in place to clean all that raw data. It's really just like a lot of raw data, and they don't know what to do with it. And so the challenges are actually that they don't have the proper tools needed to use that data. And so that's what they're worried about. They're not worried about like privacy or confidentiality or respecting the data that it's kind of gathered in a way that, you know, individuals don't really know what's happening. They're worried that they have too much of it and they can't find, you know, they can't see everything what's going on. So the key topic of discussion isn't the availability of the big data, it's the tools to process, store, and analyze it. And so it's pretty concerning, because, you know, who are these people and what are they doing with all this data? And like I said, no oversight. So I didn't get permission for them to collect my data, you know. Did you? So it's an interesting dynamic, and it's trending in the way where central banks are using more big data. And that shouldn't really be surprising, given, you know, where our world has gone, that just like big tech companies who utilize data in certain ways, that central banks would do the same. But there's really no talk around that. And that's what kind of bugged me. And from their own literature, you know, it's happening. It's happening. It's on the increase. So,
right. Are they scraping social media data?
Yes, that's actually in their paper. They obtain data from newspapers, social media, really, really everywhere. Because, like I said, like it's not. I think the Bank of International Settlements has the most data, like the most financial data out of any institution. So they scrape everything, and now they're just trying to get tools to process, store, and analyze it.
I wonder how much, have you seen anything about how much they spend on the information technology to manage the data or the tools to analyze the data? And it's kind of scary just thinking about them collecting and holding all this data.
Yeah, it's like a honeypot, right?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't even thinking about it from a honeypot perspective. I was thinking about more from the ability to just work the data later down the road. And use the data against us, but also clearly from a honeypot perspective, I think that's part of the plan as well. I think there's back end schemes on that, but do you think SDRs are connected or a bridge to CBDCs?
Well, yeah, not really. I mean,
is that sort of one era to a net to another, or was SDRs almost? It seems like SDRs were, to me, sort of rolling out CBDCs at a national level.
Well, it's like it's hard to see a scenario where central banks around the world would give up their privilege of printing money to a international organization to do it for them. So I don't know if it's like a precursor to a CBDC. Because they're just like an unregulated organization, and I just can't see the Fed ever giving up that power to them. And it's not really what they do. So I don't really see the CDR that way. It's kind of like this just band-aid fix of liquidity from when things started breaking down in the Bretton Woods system that has just stayed around as the IMF has started to denominate all their loans in it. And then the IMF and World Bank became more prevalent over the last three decades. And the SDR is just their unit of account that they use. And it's just a basket of currency, or currency backed by a basket of fiats. And so CBDC would be a little different. You know, there's talk of central banks having their own CBDCs and then having like a uniform platform that's global where they can all kind of be fungible with one another. So it's a little different.
What does that mean? So what is their vision for CBDCs? What sort of do they think they could achieve with CBDCs? And why not a different one for each country? Why this sort of global fungible platform?
Well, so the thing about the biz is that they're focused on improving the transaction capabilities of international finance. And cross-border payments have been so expensive despite our technological innovations over the last few decades, they still remain pretty expensive. So when the biz looks at the CBDC, they're like, this is finally it. This is the technology that's going to reduce cross-border payments. It's going to improve financial inclusion. It's going to help us do all these great things, deliver monetary policy more targeted and more effectively, and all these great things, right? And so I don't know if they're like evil. Maybe they're just misguided or ignorant of the negative consequences that CBDCs could have. But they're looking at it really positively. And so if you think about how the biz is viewing this in that mindset, if each jurisdiction had their own CBDC that couldn't talk to one another and it was just siloed there, it would really defeat the purpose of the CBDC from the business perspective, because it's not helping cross-border payments, it's not helping make it cheaper. And so they kind of run into this problem. And so that their solution for is what they call a multi-CBDC or MCBDC, which would be a single larger CBDC platform. And then you have these little ones that could interact with it and be interoperable. But then somebody like the biz or an international financial system would set the rules of a broader multi-CBDC system. And it would allow for fungibility between all these different CBDCs. And that's scary, because they even write like there will be one playbook for this multi-CBDC, but they don't specify who's going to make the rules, who's going to enforce the rules, who's going to do all these things. And nobody elected these people, and they're the ones kind of making the plans of the future of the global financial system. And that's what really grinds my gears about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'll say it for you. I'm not sure, but like in my kids' terminology, like all of this is sus. And especially based on, you know, sort of past behavior. And when I think about World War II and what we talked about there, and I think about this organization and its sort of struggle for survival, I don't think of it as that dire, because sort of all the participants appear to be well off without the organization. They seem to be successful people in the world of finance. They're lords of finance generally before they join the organization. But even back then, it seemed like if this organization failed, most of the sponsors would have been okay. And they didn't necessarily need to save the organization by doing immoral things. And then I look to where we are now, and I think about CBDCs, and I'm trying to glean what do they advocate for most when it comes for like over the last year in your readings, like in terms of CBDCs, is that tied to identity? Is that why they need a global sort of platform so they can actually get back down to the user level?
Yeah. So that's another whole thing is that, you know, CBDCs don't really work unless everyone's on like kind of a digital ID system. It's kind of like a precursor because if you almost like eliminate cash or any kind of escape valve for a CBDC, so everyone gets on it and then they could implement monetary policy and have that ready to go. And so that's why you kind of see like a really push in their literature for a digital ID system. And you see that really across all of these international organizations. And, you know, the UN in their 2030 goals, you know, digital ID system is way up there. And so, you know, the biz kind of sees like a global digital ID system as a precursor to their CBDC system. And so they're trying to figure out how to do that while protecting user privacy. They always like have a sentence or two about it. But really, it seems like from their writings, just in terms of just word count and how many paragraphs are allotted to this, that they're more focused on like how CBDCs and a digital ID system could create a highly efficient new digital payment system, enabling broad access and all these great things. But they don't consider the privacy and the issues of authoritarianism and the power that it would give these central banks to make sure that they're using that power responsibly. Like ideally, you don't give them that power at all, right? From the get-go, because humans are known to abuse power. And when you give them absolute power, like a digital currency attached to a digital ID, I mean, you could basically delete somebody with a keystroke,
right?
Any kind of dissident. So that's kind of where the digital ID system pops in there, because it would be really difficult to have a global CBD system if everyone was either on different digital IDs or if people were off the digital ID and they were just kind of not in the system at all. It would defeat the purpose of the entire thing. And so they want to get everybody on this federated digital ID system to enable their CBD system.
Right. And so when I follow that along, I obviously, if you link the global CBDC down to the end user, you can affect monetary policy, economic policy. You could do things like negative interest rates and lots of different things. But on the long arc of history, and I don't know how long it is, it's the merger of economic policy meets social policy.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of curious what, from your reading of their work, what has the Bank of International Settlements learned from looking at China?
So the China one was interesting because they had this paper and they basically talked about, because China has their digital yuan project. It's actually farther ahead than any other CBDC project. And essentially what they found was that in China, they basically had these people who had defaulted on auto loans, and they basically had the data right there and they basically released it publicly and shamed them. And then from that, multiple businesses shut them out of the economy in China. And so it forced them to pay off their auto loans, or else they were completely blacklisted from all sorts of businesses and activities and society. And biz just threw this in there. They're actually talking about Alibaba and Tencent and how the rise of tech giants might threaten central banks' power as well. But then they just threw in this like paragraph on that, and it was so misplaced. And it was just extremely alarming to even see that in print. Like somebody thought that was a good idea to write about how essentially the People's Bank of China used their digital yuan program to blacklist people, essentially, to force human behavior is how they put it. So I guess they're taking notes. I don't really know why they're so focused on that. But it goes to show you what could happen there. And that's actually what there's an interviewee at the IMF. They had interviewed this author and they'd say, like, what are some of the risks with CBDCs? And he said exactly what you said. The risk is that even in a benevolent government could use this to move economic policy to social policy. And that's the real risk. And that's with a benevolent government, because that's still a problem. Even if you think they're good, like, you're using economic policy to push social narratives or social policy. And that's what the CBDC could really enable these banks to have, essentially. And that's troublesome. It's troublesome to anybody, I think. Even if you love the government, you should be very, very concerned about them having that kind of power.
The example of the auto loans is such an odd example, and it makes me think that they're sitting on thousands of examples, because I don't think that's the only example you could draw from Chinese society. You'd have to have done an inept research project to only come up with that example. So it seems like they're trying to use that quirky example to highlight some sort of good, when it's really hard to pull out, I think, the moral goodness from sort of that oversight. It seems like Yelp reviews on the end user, and a horrible way to squash people. So how far along do you think China is when we talk about, like, what the biz is trying to do arm in arm with maybe some other organizations around CBDCs and maybe what the end goal is with the digital yuan? I mean, it seems to me like China is already there, that they're able to affect a lot of these things in their current informational technological structure right now. And so what do you think everyone who's looking at this experiment in China, or like who likes this program, maybe the biz or the IMF, like, what do you think they want to see China achieve more of? And what hasn't China, like, because it seems like China's able to affect a lot of this social policy through economic means already. It seems like they're able, with between Tencent and Alibaba, to kind of gather all this data already, at least for one country.
Yeah.
Or do you think there's a lot more innovation that even China is going to do?
Well, China is far along, and it's partly because of their, you know, government structure. They don't have, like, democracy, and they don't have to protect people's privacy or anything like that. They just do whatever they want. They just say, no, you're going to use this now. And so at the same time, they just blatantly collect all the data on their citizens, which gives them a lot of basically research to use, which it would be really hard for the Fed just to drop Fedcoin and force everyone to use it and then collect all that market research to better their product of the CBDC. So that's what China can do right now. And that's what they've been doing for a while. And so it's kind of hard to tell, though, because it's not like everyone's rushing out to use this thing who's not in China. I mean, it's being coerced on people. Yeah.
Well, through the Belt and Road Project, maybe down the road, but yeah. I'm kind of curious about the experiment in China and how far along. It seems really far along.
It's farther along compared to everything else, but I think they're still working out kinks. Mm-hmm. I think they actually had it for the Olympics when it was rolling through there, but it wasn't really a big hit, like with the foreigners who came there, and you didn't really hear much about it because there was, like, kind of a big promotion going up into the Olympics, like, we're going to have our digital yuan, you know, or CBDC. But kind of what I was saying is, like, you know, it's coerced on the citizens of China. They're forced to do it. Mm-hmm. But the other people around the world, you'd be hard pressed to find somebody like, please give me that surveillance coin where the Chinese government can just track everything I do. Sure. Like, a lot of people care about that stuff outside the border of China. And I'm sure a lot of people care about it inside the border of China, but unfortunately they're coerced into using it. Now compared to other central banks, they're all doing this. Like, 86% of global central banks are conducting research on CBDCs today. 56 have communicated that they're going to continue. You have multiple programs where actually central banks are working together in pilot projects. So this is happening. I think CBDCs are inevitable. I think they are. I think we're going to see them really start to come out probably in around like 5 years. And at that point, I just hope that people understand with enough education, you know, what makes Bitcoin different and like, you know, that fork in the road of, you know, choose the future you want. Do you want a surveillance coin where you don't have any control, and, or do you want, you know, Bitcoin where nobody can control it, right? It's freedom money. So it's happening. China's the farthest along, but they're all doing it. So I think it's at this point, it's just about educating why it's a bad idea, essentially.
Right. So my story, real short, is Bitcoin, shitcoins, Bitcoin. But while I was learning about that and gaining that conviction, learned about stablecoins and then CBDCs. That was sort of my arc. And I think that's sort of a natural organic arc just around, you learn about Bitcoin / crypto. I think all crypto is bullshit, but whatever,
yeah,
using that term. And then you learn about these other things like stablecoins. And then you, I think that leads most minds to CBDCs. So my question to you though, is do you think CBDCs are a response to Bitcoin? And when I say cryptocurrency, I mean actually only Bitcoin, because it's the only cryptographic currency, but is it a response to crypto, or was CBDCs kind of always maybe part of a plan and Bitcoin is just a wrench in the plan?
From my, this is my takeaways from just reading through their literature, and they are pretty transparent about their plans. What they're not transparent about is their operations. Like when you ask me, like, what do they do with their profits? That's kind of when they become a dark box. But with their plans, you know, it seems to me that they don't take Bitcoin seriously yet. It's still just this thing, this speculative thing that, you know, doesn't make sense, deflationary, like all right. These common FUD. What they do, what they are threatened about is privately issued stablecoins. So I think the CBDCs are actually a response of the massive stablecoin adoption that we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years.
Do you think it's a response to stablecoins?
Yeah, I think it's a response to Tether and yep. It really, you just saw explosive
with all these growth, added benefits after they thought through it.
Yeah, essentially. And they're like, if we can't lose, you know, we're not going to lose our ability to manage the money, essentially, right. Or issue the money,
to these private
organizations, right. Like a Circle, like a Tether, like a Paxos. Right.
The way they lost a lot of power to the euro dollar market.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it exploded to, I think it was at like $250 billion, the stablecoin, global stablecoin market. And that was before Luna blew up and Terra. So it's about 200 million now or billion. That's what I think the response is, because when you read their literature as well, they bring up stablecoins a lot. Like, and if you listen to the Fed and the regulations, they're worried about stable coins. They're not as worried about Bitcoin. So that's kind of how I'd answer that question. And it makes sense, right? Because you've seen like a lot of countries where stablecoin adoption has happened. It's actually where countries are desperate for dollar access.
Dollarization.
Dollarization, right? Yeah. So,
and they don't want to lose out on all that dollarization to these private.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So it seems like, which is a good thing for Bitcoin for me, like in my perspective, because Bitcoin's still under their radar. Like they right. really don't see it as a threat.
Right.
And you know, we obviously, you know, think it's the real innovation yeah. here, and it's kind of like the Trojan horse here. But they're kind of focused on, stable coins. It's like that meme where there's that helicopter that blows decoys for like somebody's attacking them. They're going after these decoys,
right
we're missing Bitcoin. So it's kind of a good thing in my opinion.
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of a double-edged sword in the sense that you have the Trojan horse of Bitcoin, but we still have this Trojan horse of social control through CBDCs, which I think whether it was a reaction to stable coins or Bitcoin or just their own designs, that will be some sort of second and third order effect that I think will be latched onto. It's really just, it's hard to, especially when we think about like I'm not one for nationalism, but I think nationalism is more local than globalism. I don't want to see, some non-sovereign global entity have complete control over global monetary policy. That is frightening. Where does the Bank of International Settlements stand on, obviously COVID-19 is, and the pandemic has been very profitable for them, but where do they stand on something like vaccines?
Well, and interesting enough,
talking about
enough,
the COVID vaccine here, not
in the world. No, like interesting enough, they do a yearly macro review every year, right? It's very in depth. It's like 180 pages long. They talk about vaccines a decent amount of it, and they basically say they really push vaccines, and not to be like tinfoil hat too much, but when I talked about those digital IDs and how it's a precursor for their CBDCs, it seems like the vaccine was a way to get society used to the idea of having a digital ID. Before COVID-19, you didn't really see it that much. Some people had it, but like it was kind of very rare. After the pandemic now, you see a lot of it. Like I go into a bar and they're like, why don't you have that on your phone kind of thing? And so in the business literature, they really push vaccines as a way to get us out of the pandemic. And they talk about how countries that adopted vaccines had greater economic growth, which is really kind of questionable assumptions being made in that data. It didn't look at Africa, for instance, who didn't really have any vaccine adoption, had really low COVID rates and grew their way out of it. So you just got to ask questions. You just got to ask questions about why are they pushing the vaccine so much, and why does a financial organization like the Bank of International Settlements, what do they even have to do with vaccines? Like why, they're not like into healthcare. They're not healthcare professionals or the CDC or any of these other organizations. They're the Bank of International Settlements. They're supposed to just settle international transactions, but here they are promoting vaccines and digital IDs. And I just don't think enough people read this stuff. And I think that's part of their power is that nobody digs into this stuff. Because if they did, there'd be a lot of questions like what we're talking about right now.
Do you think they're truthful in their writings, or do you think that they're misleading?
A little bit of both, to be honest. I think sometimes they're so transparent and truthful, like you say, that I have to question if this is just ignorance, not malicious in nature, because they're so open about the idea of a CBDC, and they even bring up the fact that it could be really bad, but they think they're smarter to out-design all these issues that we talk about, like privacy and the potential for it to be used as a weapon against society, essentially. They think that they're smart enough to out-design it. But they're really honest because they do think they're smart. So they say, hey, here are the problems. Here's how we're going to overcome them. It's going to be great. It's going to be awesome for everybody. And so they're kind of truthful in that way. But then there's some other things where, sometimes around, and this is kind of moving over to the IMF, but I kind of just see these organizations as similar. But they're really not truthful about some things around proof of work, about the energy consumption, about, Bitcoin specifically. It just seems like maybe they just haven't done their research, or they're just potentially just trying to slander it by pushing these falsehoods and misinformation. So there's a little bit of that. But honestly, with their research, they're actually pretty transparent, which makes me just think that they're just ignorant, essentially.
Hmm. It seems like in 2001 with 9/11, we sort of had more international restrictions between countries around passports and movement. Now with the vaccines, like you were saying, it's very localized. Like a bar might ask you, you know, so it's much more normalized on the individual level, not just when you're maybe going to another country. Where do they stand maybe on cash? Or is there a war on cash? Do they want to see a cashless society?
Yes. So, I mean, there's been a war on cash for decades now. It started with Ken Rogoff, who's an economist. He wrote about it. You know, there was actually a push during the pandemic about cash being dirty, you know, because it had, you know, the virus on it. So cash has this like reputation of being dirty and used for nefarious purposes. And authorities don't like it because it's really hard to track cash. And it's really difficult to just hard cold cash. So a lot of, you know, drug dealers and stuff, they use cash because it's hard to track. And so with the CBDC as well, like what I was saying before, is like they're trying to cut off all the escape valves. Like they were trying to block all the exits so that everyone uses the CBDC. If everyone just withdrew their money from the bank into cash and then put it under their bank or their mattress, they would have a hard time implementing their CBDC program. And so they had a paper called like CBDC in a Cashless Society. That was the title of the paper, talking about how essentially if the general public didn't have access to cash, they would be able to implement monetary policy very effectively. But on the flip side of that, it would give them complete control if there was no way to get into cash. And if there was no cash at all, it would give the central banks or whoever was in charge of the CBDC complete control and able to implement any policy that they want. So that's when we talk about negative interest rates and, hey, you've eaten too much meat this month, Cedric. You're not going to do that anymore or else we're going to cut you off. So, you know, that's kind of how they view cash. It's an escape valve. And so there is a push to remove cash. There is proponents of that. Now, the good news is, and this is kind of something that surprised me, is that cash usage is actually on the rise, contrary to public belief, globally. So it's gone up to, I think, like 64%, it's up like 4% over the last couple of years, which is encouraging to see. It's encouraging to see cash usage not going down.
Do you know what's driving up that? Like anecdotally, like
I know it's global. So most of this is occurring like outside the US in terms of cash usage, but I'm not sure exactly what the reason is behind that. Cause it was one of the surprising takeaways in my research when I saw that, because I was expecting to see cash just going down, and it had been doing that for a while, but it's actually been going up the last couple of years. And there's some good research, I think from The Block, there was a report on stablecoin usage, and that was actually one of their takeaways, which was that cash is actually on the increase. So that's good.
That's good. I wonder what is driving it, whether it's just people holding it or using it more, or dollarization in certain economies. What is the Bank of International Settlements relationship with the Federal Reserve? Do they interact? Do they sort of communicate? Is the Bank of International Settlements part of the conversation or solution when it comes to when these entities try to solve recessions or depressions or stave off?
100%. So the Bank of International Settlements, like I said, is like an event planner. So, now to go back, let me go back a little bit, because the Fed and the Bank of International Settlements has a really rocky relationship historically. So going back to World War II, when all the nefarious things that the Bank of International Settlements was doing, the Fed chairman at the time, as well as the U.S. Treasury Secretary, Harry Dexter White, saw right through that and said, you guys are helping the Nazis. And we want you guys destroyed. We want to abolish the Bank of International Settlements. So at Bretton Woods, there was actually a big push by those two guys, the Federal Reserve guy and then Harry Dexter White, to eliminate the Bank of International Settlements. Say, we don't need you anymore. Like, you guys We don't know why you even exist in the first place. There was a big push for it. Now, the Bank of International Settlements, now John Maynard Keynes, also at the Bretton Woods, would not sign the Bretton Woods agreement if the business elimination was included. He thought it was too big of a decision to just throw into the Bretton Woods agreement. And so he walked away. I think he actually went back to England. And then they eventually removed that. And then the biz just survived that by the skin of their teeth. And so John Maynard Keynes came back. They signed a Bretton Woods agreement, but the Bank for International Settlement survived. But the Fed never kind of trusted them like all these other banks. They always kind of doubted the Bank for International Settlements. It wasn't until, I believe, the late 80s or the 90s where the Federal Reserve became a member bank of the Bank of International Settlements. And now the Federal Reserve is just another member bank of the Bank of International Settlements, just like any other central bank that's a part of a member bank of the Bank of International Settlements. So very like interesting history between them. But now they're just now, like I said, Ben Bernanke was involved, was on the board of the Bank of International Settlements in the early 2000s or 2010s. And so now they're just kind of like, they're buddy buddies now. And so now whenever there's a global financial crisis, usually there's committees that happen every month at the Bank of International Settlements of these central bankers, and they speak about what's going on and how we're going to fix this. And so that's kind of what the Bank of International Settlements does with their event plannings and their committees and their seminars and their innovation hub, where they're kind of right in the middle there, where these central bankers kind of meet at the business headquarters to discuss the topics of the day, the problems facing the financial system. And the Fed's just a part of that now. So interesting history of not being so friendly with each other. But now, all of that's under the bridge. And now they're just like every other central bank. They just kind of work with the biz.
Right. In your opinion, does that sort of make the Bank of International Settlements, does that place the biz on top of the Federal Reserve? Does that mean the Federal Reserve sort of like bent the knee?
Kind of. When they finally bent the knee and joined as a member bank, it definitely was viewed that way by some people. Federal Reserve is a little different because we do have the global reserve currency of the world. They do have kind of like a unique power compared to other central banks. They're the big honcho. And the Bank of International Settlements is still just this organization on top that kind of tracks the flows of finance and has a lot of influence on policy decisions. But the Fed has this thing called the US dollar that they can also print. So they have kind of like a certain power. I would just say that the Bank of International Settlements kind of operates above the Fed, but it's kind of hard to say that they have more power than the Fed, because it's not like the Fed has to listen to everything the Bank of International says or anything like that. They're still like an independent organization compared to the Bank of International Settlements. Now, the Bank of International Settlements also doesn't have to listen to the Fed. So I wouldn't even say like one has more power than the other. I just would say they have different powers, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Kind of. Yeah.
Do you think the euro is a predecessor to some sort of global fungible CBDC?
Well, now we're, so the euro is just a mess. That's from the European Central Bank. So this is actually a good example of how the Bank of International Settlements influences policy, because the euro was actually the brainchild of the Bank of International Settlements. 1989, they thought it was a great idea. Like, hey, we got to unite Europe and we got to have them on one currency to improve cross-border payments, right? That's always their thing. And they're like, how do we get this going? So then Bank of International Settlements comes out with all these working papers, all these literature, similar to what we're seeing with the CBDCs now. They did that with the euro back in like the early 90s. And it took almost a decade of lobbying and, being in the ears of bankers to finally create the European Central Bank in 1999. And once again, that was created under a treaty. just like the Bank of International Settlements. So the ECB has similar legal immunities as the Bank of International Settlements. So it's almost like their little, I don't know, little kid, because it was their brainchild, and it is very, very protected, just like the Bank of International Settlements. And so the euro has been an absolute shit show, because essentially what they do is that all the countries involved with the euro gave up their monetary sovereignty to this organization that they don't really have control over. And they didn't bring into account how each individual country in the eurozone has different needs, different cultures, different spending patterns. And to have one currency and try to have one monetary policy to manage all the different economies, it's just asinine. And that's why the euro has been a complete failure. And so it's very interesting to see the BIS, who basically created the euro, which has been a shit show, kind of deciding the same thing, but more internationally with the CBDC and their multi-CBDC program. They want one big currency, but instead of just, you know, what is it, 20-something countries in the euro, now we're talking about the entire world having this one CBDC. And if the euro didn't work, why do they think this is going to work? Like, it just seems very, very poor planning and poor long-term thinking to think that this will turn out well. And so I think the euro is a really fascinating story, and I think we can learn a lot from it. And I think it really highlights how the BIS influences things, because it's like when they have these papers, it's like it's just a theory on a paper in the beginning, but then it becomes a reality 10, 20 years later. And you know, I think we're seeing the same thing play out with CBDCs right now in terms of the Bank of International Settlements and their plans for the world.
Yeah. And so we think about plans for the world and the ability to plan and shape the world. I don't think, maybe control is not the right word, but shape, steer, drive. And I think a lot about, you know, I've seen a bunch of cycles through my life now. And I'll just note the last few, sort of like 2000, 2001, 2008, the great financial crisis. And I think of March 2020. And going into March 2020, I kind of thought about that as maybe some early fireworks. But now I'm starting to, my emotional response or my sort of reaction to what I'm seeing is maybe we're through the worst of the 2020-2021 cycle. Maybe they are able to manage this in a way that this enormous inflation won't be mind-bending. Maybe we're sort of through. Maybe the QT that they roll out over the next few months or years still leads to upward rising markets because there's just such a hunger for the dollar. Do you think that we are sort of before or after maybe the climax of this market or business cycle in terms of them managing the economy the way they do? I mean, do you think this thing's going to break in 18 months, or, you know, maybe they're going to kick the can down the road another 10 or 12 years like they have for the last 50?
Yeah, that's the question. If they can kick this can down the road, which, you know, right now they've kind of gotten a lot of what they wanted, which is, things haven't really broken yet. Inflation's high, so it's kind of reducing the debt to GDP, which is kind of what they need. So some people say like they want this inflation, and that's really possible. We don't know their true intentions here, but it does help the debt to GDP ratio decrease to have this high inflation. At the same time, we have unemployment not spiking yet or anything like that. And so right now it's like the whole question of whether they can manage a soft landing or not. Now, for me, I just look at the amount of debt in the system and the amount of zombie companies. And I look at these interest rates, and when they have to refinance, I think we're really going to start to see some volatility and some trouble in these credit markets. And that's kind of why where I'm focused, kind of looking at these credit spreads and credit default swaps and looking at them, because it kind of leads to the potential of credit risk increases, of insolvencies, of cascading bankruptcies. And that's what happens when you have this amount of debt in the system. Everything becomes interconnected, and you have this contagion of where, you know, one bankruptcy happens and then another and then another and then another. We haven't seen that yet. And that's, I guess, good on the Fed. Like, things haven't broken yet. Now, the question is, if that does happen and these interest rates, the borrowing costs come up high and all these zombie companies eventually have to refinance and it's too expensive for them to do so. And like I said, it starts to unravel. Then it's going to be like, what's the Fed's going to do? And I think that's what everybody is wondering right now. Like, will they come in with another put? Will they just turn back on the money printer? And in that scenario, it's really surprising that it would be surprising to see people not start to really question the credibility of these central banks and the credibility of fiat currencies in general, in my mind, because when you have maybe 10 years from the global financial crisis to the COVID crisis, and they're doing all this QE and it's massive, it's huge, it's like magnitudes bigger than it was in global financial crisis, right? I think it was like we spent $1 trillion in a month or a couple of weeks or something in COVID, where that was more than all of global financial crisis. But if we have another one, and it's so soon, it's like a year or 2 years later, and it's a massive magnitudes higher, that's when people are going to really start to wake up, I think. And then once the credibility is gone of a currency or a central bank or the issuer of that currency, that's where we can really run into some hard times. And so that's kind of what I'm watching. I'm looking at the credit markets. I'm looking at financial conditions, see if we see any problems in the labor market, because those are the two things I feel like could cause the Fed to pivot and to turn back on the money printers, for lack of a better word, just to go back to QE, go back to maybe a bit more stimulus checks. And we'll see if that happens. That's kind of the million-dollar question, but that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah. How many people do you think are involved in these decisions? I mean, do you think this is 5 or 10 people, 100 or 1,000 or 10,000? I mean, is this really decentralized where all these bodies truly look at all the research that's happening and there's thousands of people involved in this? Or is this a handful of people that are really running these multinational global organizations and deciding policy?
I think it's, in terms of like their general big picture decisions, I think it's very centralized, is what I would say. It's like, it's just like the Fed, where you only have like 12 people making decisions. This is actually where they're also not transparent. So they're, like I said, they're transparent about their plans, transparent about their research, not transparent about their operations or their organizational hierarchy, especially like the IMF and the World Bank. I mean, it is confusing trying to understand who's actually making the decisions here, and whether that's intentional or not, I don't know. It's part of the reason why, especially with these large institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, Bank of International Settlements, they're actually so big too. And they're so large and bureaucratic that I think like even people who work in them, like in the IMF, doesn't even understand who's actually making the decisions. That's what it seems like to me. It's like the Tower of Babel situation where they just like, they don't even know what their goal is or mission or who's making the decisions, because it's huge. It's a huge bureaucratic institution that's had no competition for decades and decades and decades. And when you have no competition, you just rot from the inside out culturally, as well as, nobody's forcing you to be better. Let's just say that. That's just basic free market principles right there. So they've had a monopoly on their international, whether it's the biz and they're giving out cross-border payments and large exchanges, or it's the IMF giving out loans to distressed sovereign nations. They've had complete monopolies on their respected markets. And I think that's just led to really institutional, like bureaucratic rot of these institutions. And so I think it's very centralized in terms of the big decisions. And I think when the biz holds these committees and councils, I think it's just a group of high finance and central bankers that get together in Basel, and that's pretty centralized. And they're making the big decisions. If you go back to it, like Jay Powell goes there and Jay Powell comes back. And if you look at the amount of dissents that happen in the Federal Reserve meetings, they're almost non-existent for a decade. Like they almost always agree with Jay Powell on votes or the chairman in general. It's very, very rarely dissenting votes because they want to come across as a cohesive unit that agrees with each other, that they're on the same, you know, mission together. They agree with everything. This is how we're supposed to do it. And so if you think about Jay Powell going to Basel, Switzerland, the Bank of International Settlements for that, you know, monthly meeting or whatever it is, go back to the Fed, and then they never disagree with what the Jay Powell votes for, you know, it's pretty centralized from the top down. And so it is what it is. It's the exact opposite of Bitcoin, right? So if you think that central planning can work, then I think you should read some history books, because it seems to me that something as complicated as a global financial system or economy, to have a small group of people making decisions for billions of people, it's really seems like a poor choice.
Terrible choice, but it seems doable. It seems if they have enough control and enough capital, you can actually affect maybe centralized control, whether the outcomes are good or bad.
Yeah.
And that's what concerns me. My final question for you, a bit of a tinfoil hat question. So I believe in free markets. Free markets are great. People can go long, they can go short any asset. That's important for price discovery. That's organic. Do you think, though, that there are people adversarially attacking Bitcoin to suppress its price? When I say people, I mean large entities like the Bank of International Settlements or the Federal Reserve, or some entity that has off-balance sheet capital, we're not aware of their operations, has a lot of money they could afford to lose because the other revenue streams they would be protecting would be greater. Do you think there's potential, or what do you think is the potential of Bitcoin price suppression that's not organic?
It's definitely non-zero. Like, it's definitely potential that it's happening. Obviously, I have no proof of that. If you just think about, I think the IMF would be a perfect example. And I think they would be incentivized to suppress the price of Bitcoin to hurt El Salvador, to show that this is a failed experiment to all these other countries, because it would hurt the IMF if we started to have these financial products built on Bitcoin where people could raise funds and not go to the IMF. They've had a monopoly on that. And a lot of countries have a lot of problem with the IMF. They have not been treated well by them. And those loans come with terms and conditions. A loan from, a Bitcoin bond would not come with terms and conditions. The countries would have complete independence about how they use those funds. And that's attractive to different countries. And so when the IMF found out about El Salvador, they were very negative about it. They warned them about it. They suddenly, senators in the US were writing bills saying that El Salvador needs to, you know, be tracked. And basically, we need to see what's going on here. You then had the IMF go to Argentina and say, we're going to give you $45 billion, but the banks aren't allowed to deal with cryptocurrencies. Okay. So it wouldn't be surprised if they are suppressing the price of Bitcoin to basically hurt El Salvador, the only country that has it. Well, not the only country anymore, but one of the only countries that has Bitcoin as legal tender, because right now you're starting to hear things like the losses on their Bitcoin equals their next bond payment. And they're going to default on their bonds because of Bitcoin. And that's exactly the kind of narrative that the IMF would want. Now, do I know they're doing that? Does anybody know they're doing that? I don't know. But think about incentives. They would be incentivized or like to see that happen. They can print SDRs essentially. So possible. That's what I would say. It's possible. Tinfoil hat. Hopefully not, but either way, you know, Bitcoin would shrug it off long term. But the people of El Salvador, not so much. So again, that kind of pisses me off, because if they were doing that, the IMF's mission statement is to provide prosperity for everybody, and they'd be actively hurting one of their borrowing nations, the people of their borrowing nations, if they were doing that. So,
well, it's interesting. I can imagine it. I have a hard time assuming it's happening. And if it is, I think the world's a lot darker place than I want to wrap my head around.
Yeah.
Just because it's just, it's a very dark thing, even though it seems kind of benign, though someone wants to lose money on purpose. But it's a very dark thing when that, when those people can print money or issue SDRs or things of that nature.
Yeah, Larry Lepard thinks about that. He's talked about that as well. And it is a dark thing to think about, because it's almost like money really doesn't matter at all.
Yeah.
If they're just like, hey, we're going to burn this.
We're going to burn money to ruin your money.
To ruin the other money. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a very dark thing. You hope it couldn't last forever. The optimistic side of my brain really thought about them exporting inflation to Bitcoin. So being able to not have the inflation in the consumer goods, because it all went to Bitcoin. But I think their issue with that would be that it would show a real escape valve for people that were doing a true A-B test and could figure this out. And if you don't want there to be an escape valve, you don't even want to hide or mask one or let one slide. Maybe.
Yeah. And like, Christine Lagarde has said it, right? She said Bitcoin's an escape valve. Like,
and
quote
they don't
unquote.
Want, yeah.
And then, sorry, no, I just like what the IMF doesn't want is other countries to see El Salvador as a success. And then, and then they adopt it, and it's a game of dominoes, right? Which I think is inevitable. But
it was interesting when El Salvador made the announcement. I mean, I was in Miami. I just got back to my hotel room and I'm watching on a live stream, but I had tears in my eyes. And yet you would think the things of like a lot of the events of the last 18 months were very positive from a very pure economic supply and demand standpoint. And yet price never went in the direction that you would think it would go during a bull market getting good news. And so it was very odd. And then they just became so consistent, I stopped thinking of it as odd. But I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation. We leave a lot on the table. I'd love to have you back. We go more into the IMF, the World Bank. One thing, I'm not even sure if you ever looked at this. I'm curious how often the Bank of International Settlements and some of these players have appeared in the Panama Papers. I also want to note that I do want to just cap off with episode 2. Jan Pritzker, the CTO of Swan, was on the show. Episode 14, Andy Edstrom, I think Director of Investor Relations. Brandon Quinn has been on twice. Episode 19, where we look at Bitcoin through the lens of mycology and the fourth turning. And episode 108, Bitcoin as a Pioneer Species. Robert Breedlove has been on. We looked at the tyranny of time and money in slaves. And Stefan Lavera, head of, I think, your investor relations or high net worth individuals, has been episode 39. We look at the Austrian economics in one lesson. Gigi, who's no longer with Swan, but when he was on the show, he was with Swan. We look at the Bitcoin through the language of time and money. And Brady Swenson, head of education, has been on the show episode 56. Tomer Shorelight has been on the show twice, 74 and 80. Bitcoin is for everyone, and rich or poor Bitcoiners have what money can't buy, and he's coming back in 2 weeks. So definitely representing the Swan team. Appreciate how much you guys have been doing for the space. It's just enormous, and it's very important to have a Bitcoin only financial services company and brokerage firm so that we can send our friends and family somewhere that they can not be fooled like I was on Coinbase when I started out. So thank you to you guys. And I leave it to you for any final words. And I hope we covered what we set out to. And I'd love to have you back sometime, but please let know people where they can find you and your work.
Yeah, first off, thanks for bringing on Swans. I'm very privileged to work with some brilliant people. over there. And I love all those people that you just mentioned. So thank you for that. You know, I would just like to say that these are complex organizations. And I would just encourage people to read the research themselves, like go on the websites and start reading their papers and their literature, because it's really powerful to use their own words against them and to really say like, hey, this isn't us just like saying tinfoil stuff, like look at their charts, look at what we're seeing here. It's right there. So if there's listeners here, you know, go put in the work, do a little bit of research yourself. Don't trust everything that I'm saying right now. Look into the biz. There's a really great book on the biz called The Tower of Basel. If anybody wants some additional reading material, it's a really great book. So you can check that out. And just thanks for listening. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Thanks, bro. I've been sitting on the Lords of Finance. I'll check that out.
That's a good one too.
And I didn't know about the Tower of Basel. That sounds very interesting. Fascinating organizations. I can't wait till we speak again. And I hope to see you in August at Black Boom.
Oh, you will, brother. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
This episode was brought to you by CypherSafe. Check out CypherSafe.io to keep your sats safe and get 10% off your seed storage devices using the code MATRIX. If you enjoy the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, please tell your friends and family about the show. Give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform and support our sponsors. Those are some of the best ways to help the show gain awareness, grow, and become sustainable so we can keep bringing you fresh and dope conversations with the most interesting people in the space. And as always, thank you for listening. Stack sats, stay humble, and stay laser focused out there. This is Sed. Peace.